Support for WMFE comes from Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University's worldwide campus, where highly ranked online degree programs offer the flexibility to learn what students want from wherever they are. More at erau.edu/worldwide.
The politics of space and the latest night sky observations. You're listening to Are We There Yet? The radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. The Trump administration is bringing many changes to NASA, including proposed budget cuts and a new leader. How is political science affecting rocket science, and how might shifting political winds affect the future of space exploration? We'll speak with Chris Carberry, CEO of Explore Mars, about the future of space policy. Then, from meteor showers to our sun burping out giant flares, there's a lot going on in the skies this fall, and all you need to do is look up. We'll speak with Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University's Terry Oswalt and the Daytona Beach Museum of Art and Sciences' Seth Mayo about how to see the astronomical show. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? From moon missions to spacecraft flying to study Earth's neighboring planets, there's a lot happening in this decade with space exploration missions. But how could politics and policy changes affect some of these missions? In a recent op-ed by Chris Carberry titled, "Let's Not Allow the Golden Age of Space Exploration to Turn Itself into Fool's Gold," the CEO of Explore Mars argues this: political shifts and budget cuts could drastically impact the future of space exploration in the U.S. He joins us now to unpack the political science of space exploration. Chris, welcome back to Are We There Yet?
Thanks for having me on.
So, Chris, you've got a recent op-ed published called "Let's Not Allow the Golden Age of Space Exploration to Turn Instead into Fool's Gold." Let's talk about that fool's gold concern. What worries you about this golden age of space exploration and the policy time that we're in today?
Well, it's interesting. We are simultaneously poised for that golden age of space exploration, but also poised to let it all fade away, and by our own fault as well. You know, we are lined up. We have all these, of course, wonderful launch vehicles in development. You know, we're poised to do Artemis II early next year. Commercial sector is just blooming everywhere. But at the same time, policy-wise, things are in chaos. Now, this happens when you have changes in administration and other things. But, you know, and then when you add the government shutdown as well, when there was already people didn't know where things were going. And so it's kind of really disrupted some of the flow. So we're hoping now that, you know, that things can move forward. Because right now, the space industry has been in a wait-and-see mode. And there's lacking confidence right now which direction we're going. And as well as, like, for instance, you probably heard this concern about when we're going to be able to return to the moon. So I think all of this stuff, all of our goals are possible, but we need to be able to regroup and refocus so that we re-clarify these ambitious goals and how we're going to get them done.
You've identified kind of a policy challenge when it comes to space exploration, especially with long-term space exploration goals like putting humans on the moon or Mars, right? These goals tend to transcend political administrations, right? And that's what's really difficult. It takes more than 8 years to get humans to Mars. However, we've got another Trump administration in here. What has changed from that first Trump administration's policy goals to this second Trump administration?
It's a little hard to define. President Trump, in his inaugural, did recommit to the goal of sending humans to Mars. Also, in his statement to Congress, committed to that goal. But since then, of course, we have proposed NASA budget that cuts dramatically from the NASA budget, particularly from science, which proposed cuts are like 47% of the NASA science budget. And I think for some reason, there's a disconnect, the understanding how science really does help in those broader goals, human exploration goals. We've had the most successful Mars robotic mission ever orchestrated. You know, we've learned so much in the last more than two decades about the potential of life on Mars, geology of Mars, you know, but also resources on Mars. It has really helped us move forward, gaining the understanding to be able to send humans, but we're not done yet. And hopefully Congress and the administration will understand, you know, if we can explain it well to them, we cannot cut back on science dramatically, because this really helps us get to those aspirational human goals as well as understanding the broader nature of the universe, which I think we all are, you know, interested in finding out.
What is the best way to frame this conversation, Chris. As someone who is advocating to get humans on Mars, there is, as you mentioned, the importance of collecting the science. But the framing has been now we need to beat China to these goals, beat China back to the moon, beat China to Mars. From a policy standpoint, is that the best way to look at this?
I think it would be a mistake to frame it all as beating China. You know, if we go back to the Apollo program, the entire program was framed around beating the Soviet Union. And of course it worked. We did. But once we had beaten the Soviet Union, we lacked the motivation to continue. Well, we've beaten them. And then we were left, oh, well, we no longer need to do this. Oh, the Soviet Union is now pursuing space stations. Let's go do space stations. And so I think, you know, it's kind of prior to the growth of China's space program, you know, the Mars community for, frankly, 20 years or more has been building a broad set of reasons, rationales for sending humans to Mars well beyond, you know, beating China, you know, back to the moon or onto Mars. It has been lining it up, you know, to show how the impact it has on national morale, the impact it has on innovation development, on discovering things, whether there's life outside of Earth. You know, may take humans there to actually figure out if there's life on Mars. We've found a lot of great indicators, but it may well take humanity being there, putting a shovel in the dirt to find out for sure whether there's life on another planet. You can go on and on and on with this rationale, but also giving people budgetary context. Back in 2013, Explore Mars did a survey, a scientific survey. Nobody knew we were doing it. We hired a professional polling company. And this was in the middle of, you know, another budgetary problem, sequestration, you may recall, when they were cutting way back. And we were afraid that, you know, what would happen if only like 30% of people supported humans to Mars and Mars science. But we knew one of the biggest challenges was that people had, you know, misconstrued what the NASA budget was. You always hear these stories of people thinking it's similar to the military or similar to Social Security, things like that. And so we wanted to make sure that we gave them budgetary context. So the first question of that poll was, what percentage of the federal budget do you think NASA accounts for? And we gave them only a sliding scale between 0 and 5%. The average answer was 2.5%, which was in itself was more than five times more what the budget actually was. Then we told them the answer. Then we asked them the rest of the questions. And then when they came back, 70% approval for humans to Mars, 70% approval for Mars science, 70% thought we should double NASA's budget, you know, when we gave them the budgetary context. And I think that's part of it because people have this, understandably, when they think it's a choice between Social Security and going to Mars, Social Security is going to win every day, as it should. But when they understand that Social Security and Medicare account for 40% of the federal budget, whereas right now NASA's 0.4%, those social programs get 100 times the funding of NASA. So when you understand that even if we eliminated NASA altogether and we put them into the programs, you think increasing Social Security and Medicare by 1% is going to solve the problems of those programs? No, but we will have lost one of the biggest drivers for innovation, inspiration, and drivers for the economy, frankly.
You're listening to Are We There Yet?, the radio show exploring space exploration. I'm Brendan Byrne. We're speaking with Chris Carberry, CEO and co-founder of Explore Mars, a nonprofit space advocacy organization created to advance the goal of sending humans to Mars by the mid-30s, about space policy. We're talking about his recent op-ed titled, Let's Not Allow the Golden Age of Space Exploration to Turn Itself into Fool's Gold.
This is why, you know, with the op-ed, wanted to make sure people understood we are on the verge of truly great things, but we are also teetering on the edge of whether we're going to shoot ourselves in the foot and let others take over what we are prepared to do. I think the United States is well prepared to be leaders in space exploration for the rest of the century if we decide to do so. And it's not just, oh, commercial will do it all or NASA will do it all. It's finding the right balance between them on what does government do well and what does the commercial sector do well. Yes, we'll make mistakes, but finding that balance, as you mentioned, it's difficult from administration to administration, but we have had, I mean, it has been bipartisan space exploration support for many years. And it's one of the few things, it's like a unicorn within space, within American political policies. And that's worth supporting just in itself, something to tether us together. But, you know, the general goals of the moon and Mars have been held together for several administrations, you know, starting George W. Bush onto Obama, onto first Trump administration, onto Biden, and onto the second Trump administration. But right now, it's been very slow motion, but we do need to find a way, you know, hopefully this administration and Congress can come together for this ambitious goal, which frankly, from a budgetary perspective, isn't a lot of money, but it can have such an incredible impact on the country and as a tool for soft power around the world.
You mentioned that proverbial shot to the foot. Has that shot already been fired, though, Chris? You look at the budget proposal that slashes science. You know, your organization wants humans on the surface of Mars, but this administration has cut the Mars sample return funding. Has the damage already been done?
Damage has been done. Of course, that budget hasn't been put in place yet. But there has been a lot of cuts to NASA, as there have been throughout the federal budget. And NASA's bleeding expertise, there is a brain drain at NASA. And so I don't think it's too late, but we need to act fast. And hopefully, if we just find a way to really push through and, you know, work with the administration, find ways to do this in a way that accommodates what everybody's looking for here. And one of the things that I believe Isaacman has been pushing for, and I agree with part of it, you may have heard about Project Athena. It's basically a white paper he produced back in May, before, I think it must have been right before he was ousted as the nominee before, kind of giving an outline of what his approach would be to NASA, basically to reorganize NASA, how it approach, you know, science and exploration. Some of it does talk about reorganizing, restructuring NASA. And I believe, you know, some restructuring of NASA is absolutely needed. There needs to be more efficiency, specifically between the mission directorates. One of the things that we have advocated for years, and what we actually got, was the Moon Mars Program Office. So these are the sorts of things that can be done. And I'm hoping that he'll sit down, not just with folks at NASA, but other people around the community to really figure out what could work, what makes sense, what doesn't make sense, and see if we can find the right balance and also still maintain that bipartisan spirit that NASA and space exploration has always had.
Finally, Chris, though, are you optimistic that space exploration, particularly human space exploration, can transcend what is currently happening in DC from a policy standpoint? We are more divisive than ever before. Is there still a place for space to rise above that and be that kind of inspiration that you've been speaking about?
I think it can. I like being realistic as well. I mean, but it's going to take a lot of hard work. And it's not just up to NASA. It's not up to, you know, the next administrator or even the president or Congress. It will take the space industry and people who care about it continually push Congress and the administration to show that this is something we care about as a nation. This is something that is, you know, transcend that partisanship. It's going to be a lot of heavy lifting. But once again, even with the damage that's been done, I think we are still positioned. We're about to launch the first mission to the lunar, you know, system since 1972 in February. In a commercial sector still is moving forward. And maybe there are, you know, it's a difficult thing. We're not moving as quickly as we'd like, but we have so many different opportunities. But we also understand that China has very strong, ambitious goals. They stick to it. You know, they brought back samples from the far side of the moon. They've said they're going to land humans on the moon by 2030. They hope to send sample return for Mars in, think, 2031. It's something we can't ignore, because even if they're not moving quickly, they are moving steadily. The more we just sit around, they will eventually surpass us. And maybe that'll happen even if we take all the right steps, but it certainly will happen if, you know, we continue doing what we're doing now and seeming like we're sabotaging ourselves.
Chris Carberry is the CEO and co-founder of Explore Mars, a nonprofit space advocacy organization created to advance the goal of sending humans to Mars by the mid-2030s. He's also the author of the recent op-ed, Let's Not Allow the Golden Age of Space Exploration to Turn Itself into Fool's Gold. Chris, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
Still to come, with cooler weather in the Northern Hemisphere, it's the perfect time to look up at our night sky.
It wipes out the humidity, so the transparency of the sky improves and the clouds tend to go away.
What's up in the skies this fall? That's ahead on Are We There Yet?
Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from Daytona Beach International Airport, offering new nonstop service to New York City and Boston, Massachusetts, beginning December 4th. Daytona Beach International Airport features convenient access to the terminal, easy and close parking, and more. Details at flydab.com.
You're listening to Are We There Yet?, the radio show exploring space exploration from Central Florida Public Media. I'm Brendan Byrne. In the commercial space race, there are two heavy hitters, SpaceX's Elon Musk and Blue Origin's Jeff Bezos. Washington Post reporter Christian Davenport examines these space rivals and explores how they're fueling the nation's latest space race in his book, Rocket Dreams, Musk, Bezos, and the Inside Story of the New Trillion-Dollar Space Race. We speak with Davenport next week on Are We There Yet? But for now, we're talking about astronomical observations. With colder skies and less humidity in the Northern Hemisphere this fall, it's easier for space enthusiasts to stargaze and see all kinds of things like meteors, comets, and even our neighboring planets. And all you really need to do is just look up at the sky to see it all. And while a lot of these things can be seen with the naked eye, sometimes all you need is binoculars or a simple telescope to have that push to see things a little more clearly. Here to talk about what's going on in our skies and how to best see it all is Seth Mayo and Terry Oswalt. Seth is the planetarium director at the Lohmann Planetarium at the Museum of Arts and Sciences in Daytona Beach. Terry is a professor of physics and astronomy at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University in Daytona Beach. Terry, Seth, welcome back to Are We There Yet?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hey, so there's lots of cool things to see in the sky in these months. But before we get to that, I want to talk about why this time of year is so great for observing in the sky. We're recording this on a day where it is extremely cold in Florida for the first time all year. But that means the skies are probably going to be easier to see these things, right, Terry?
Yeah, I got my flannel shirt on today, too. It wipes out the humidity, so the transparency of the sky improves and the clouds tend to go away. And you might freeze your hindquarters off, but you'll be able to see the sky better.
Seth, despite the cool temperatures, is this your favorite time to be looking at the night sky?
Oh, certainly, yeah. And I love the stars and constellations that are up at this time of year in the fall, and especially the wintertime. You have some really bright objects that really shine.
Terry, we are taping this on a day where you are going to go out and look for aurora. First of all, what are you going to be looking for in the night sky, and what's prompting you to keep an eye out for this?
Well, the sun has been unusually active. It's been on the high side of its 11-year activity cycle for over a year now. We're supposed to be on the downslope of its activity cycle, but just within the last day or so, an X-class flare has occurred, and there have been a couple other burps right before that, and all three of those puffs of plasma from the sun are on their way here, and they're supposed to collide with the Earth's upper atmosphere and magnetic field tonight and tomorrow night. So the upper tier of the United States is almost guaranteed to have some aurora. I'm doubtful that we'll see it all the way down here in Florida, but it's a big enough flare. It's comparable to one that occurred about a year ago that caused some fantastic aurora displays. So fingers crossed, I'm going to go out and look when I take the garbage out. I'm going to go look and take a picture if there's any hint of an aurora in our sky.
We're going to be hearing this conversation after that that solar burp has passed. But is there a way that you can keep an eye out on for these things? Is there a notification that you know that the sun has kind of spewed some stuff at us?
Yeah, there's a whole host of resources, but probably the most common one that the general public has access to is space.com and spaceweather.com and NOAA, the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, maintains a website. So all three of those, just Google those three organizations and you'll straight away start to see some notices.
Seth, what are you keeping your eyes on in the night sky these days?
One particular object I've been really just following, and it's just fun to look at with the telescope, is Saturn. Saturn has been rising steadily in our southeastern sky and just has been looking great. The rings are very edge-on to us right now. We kind of crossed the ring plane early this year, and so we're still seeing a very edge-on view of the rings. They're very, very thin. So that's kind of a unique view of Saturn at the moment. And so as that's rising higher and higher, it's just easier to see, kind of closer to the zenith where things look just a little bit better in the sky. And then what's also been great with planets as well is as we're now looking towards the east, waiting for Jupiter to rise. And now it's starting to rise earlier and earlier. And as we get into the wintertime, we'll also kind of join the sky with Saturn. So they're kind of both out at the same time. And Jupiter is the second brightest planet you can see from Earth and another great target through a telescope, just like Saturn. You know, Saturn, you can see rings, but also moons. With Jupiter, you can see its four Galilean moons that move quite quickly around this large planet. And even through a small telescope, you can see the cloudy bands across Jupiter. It's such a big planet and a very reflective planet like Saturn is. So those planets I'm really looking out for and excited to look at, especially through telescopes.
What about with the naked eye? What if I don't have a telescope or binoculars? Will I still be able to see some sort of evidence of these planets in the night sky?
What you will see are still what look like bright stars. You know, you might not be able to resolve, you know, rings or moons with your naked eyes, but what you can see, these planets look like non-twinkling stars. And that's why I always tell folks in the planetarium or elsewhere, how do you tell the difference? Well, first off, you know, stars twinkle because of our atmosphere. Planets, not so much, or at least not noticeable to our eyes. Also, if you watch them throughout the year, they move against the backdrop of stars, right? They're originally known as wandering stars, right? And it's what we thought they were. And so until we realize, because of the telescope, that they're these planets in our solar system. So the non-twinkling nature of them and also how they move against the backdrop of the night sky kind of make them obvious or make them look a little different than something else you might be looking at, like a star in the sky.
I'd like to say that binoculars are better than the telescope Galileo used to discover the moons of Jupiter. So if you can hold your binoculars steady by putting your elbows up on the windowsill or the back of your car or something, you can see the moons of Jupiter and the rings of Saturn. And the way that I tell my students to look for planets is, you know where the sunset went down or where the sunrise is beginning, and you probably can see the moon. Draw an imaginary line between the sun and the moon. That's not too far off the plane of the solar system usually. You see a bright object along that line, it's almost certainly a planet, if it's not twinkling especially.
Speaking of seeing the moon, I've read somewhere that the moon has been kind of incredible these past few weeks, and it's been throwing off being able to make these observations in the sky. Has the moon been brighter than usual?
It went through perigee recently. That's called the supermoon because it's a little bit brighter because it's a little bit nearer to us, but it's also the time of year when the sky is a little clearer and the moon is a little bit more dramatically contrasty in the sky, and it's a little higher in the sky than it would be during the other side of the calendar.
Yeah, especially in the fall too, you know, you have the corn moon and the harvest moon when the moon is kind of rising at kind of a more inclined angle. And so you have more time with the moon rising. And so you get this great view a little bit longer in the evening when the moon looks really large closer to the horizon. And that happens around the fall. It creates this thing called the moon illusion, right? Where your brain thinks the moon looks larger and bigger, right? Like, almost like watching it in a movie or something. And when the moon is low and you notice it longer in the lower section of the sky, it just seems so much bigger and more imposing to you. So that does happen a lot at this time of the year in particular.
You can prove to yourself that it's an illusion by holding your little pinky out at arm's length and using it to cover up the moon when it's near the horizon. And then a couple hours later, do the same thing. You'll find the moon's the same size.
Very interesting. Very interesting indeed. You're listening to Are We There Yet?, the radio show exploring space exploration from Central Florida Public Media. I'm Brendan Byrne. We're speaking with Seth Mayo and Terry Oswalt about what you can see in the skies this fall. Seth is the planetarium director at the Lohmann Planetarium at the Museum of Arts and Sciences in Daytona Beach. Terry is a professor of physics and astronomy at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University. How about some meteor showers? Those are always fun to see. Any on the horizon, pun intended?
Well, we're waiting for the Geminids. That's the one of the preeminent meteor showers of the year, coming in early to mid-December. It's a time when we're passing in our orbit around the sun through the debris material from a former comet, in this case a mysterious object called 3200 Phaeton, originally classified as an asteroid, but it's been discovered to be a pretty active asteroid. And so it's believed to be an evaporated hulk of an old comet. But we pass through that debris. That's the cause of almost all the meteor showers that we go through during the year. Different comets leave different debris trails behind them. And what we're seeing when we see those quote-unquote shooting stars in the sky are roughly dust grain-sized pieces of rock and mineral that have been thrown out of a comet when it evaporates. And it's kind of like love bugs hitting our windshield. When the Earth is moving through its orbit, the love bugs are hitting our windshield, especially when we're on the leading side of the Earth in its orbit. And that occurs between midnight and dawn. So that's when you're most likely to see those love bugs hitting our windshield.
Mm-hmm. Another very Florida-centric analogy there, right? Love bug.
And then one that's coming up more recently now, too, is the Leonid meteor shower coming up this month as well. So we actually have two great ones, like Terry said, Geminids in December, Leonids in November. What's great is that the moon is not going to cause a lot of extra light. So the moon will be at a smaller phase, right? We always want to time those things out, right? I mean, that's just the way nature works, right? Sometimes the moon is full during a meteor shower. It's not as decent because the extra light from the moon. Sometimes in the case of this year for Leonids and Geminids, the moon will be at a smaller phase, actually in its crescent, waning crescent phases on both of those meteor showers. So for the one coming up soon, Leonids, which is the morning of November 17th, also possibly November 18th, this is a meteor shower from a comet called Temple Tuttle that's been known since the 1800s. And similar to, as Terry mentioned about the Geminids, we are passing through the kind of debris trail of that particular comet, usually mid to late November of each year.
You can see some before midnight, but it's kind of like looking out the side or the back of your car window at the love bugs going by.
So is the best way to see these cosmic love bugs just to sit and look at the sky for an extended period of time and hope you see something streak across?
You don't need any equipment at all other than your two eyes and maybe a comfortable lounge chair and a coat.
Yes. Something to keep that back end warm, right, Terry?
Yeah.
Yeah. And sometimes the names, you know, stem from the radiant point from which they come from, right? So Leonids come from Leo, Geminids come from Gemini. And it does not mean you have to know where those constellations are. You just can trace them back to that location. And so, you know, laying back, going to a dark location, having patience, of course, just enjoying nature and the night sky. And you just need to look at the whole sky, and that's the best thing you can do. And you might catch one of these very ancient pieces of material from the beginnings of our solar system that never made it into a planet or our sun or a moon, streaking through the sky and eventually kind of entering Earth's atmosphere. So they're so much fun to enjoy. Just, you know, enjoy the whole sky. You don't have to just enjoy the meteors. You can enjoy a planet or two, the constellations, all at the same time. So it's a fun way to just enjoy the stars above.
And finally, before I let you go, another astronomical event that has been making headlines, 3i Atlas. Is this something that we can see, or is this something that we should be worried about?
Well, there are actually a half a dozen comets in the sky right now, but unfortunately, every one of them requires at least a small telescope to see. And 3i Atlas is definitely one of the fainter of them, but it has the distinction of being the third object that isn't part of the solar system passing through. This happens to be one of those pieces of some other star system that's passing by. And we know it's from outside the solar system because it has an orbit that is unbound to the sun. And it's clearly a comet, despite what you might see in some of the social media. It's no alien. It's a comet.
Terry, Seth, thank you so much for bringing us up to speed on what's happening in the night sky. Appreciate it.
Thanks very much.
Just keep looking up.
That was Seth Mayo, Planetarium Director at the Lohmann Planetarium at the Museum of Arts and Sciences in Daytona Beach, and Terry Oswalt, Professor of Physics and Astronomy at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University. And that's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Stay connected with this show. Follow us on social media. We're on Instagram and Facebook at @AWTYSpace. If you've got an idea for a future episode of the show, or you think you might be a nice guest, well, reach out to us. We're at arewetthereyet@cfpublic.org. Are We There Yet is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our intern is Orion Boone. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Editorial guidance from LaToya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.